This episode is brought to you by Progressive Insurance. Whether you love true crime or comedy, celebrity interviews or news, you call the shots on what's in your podcast queue. And guess what? Now you can call them on your auto insurance too with the Name Your Price tool from Progressive. It works just the way it sounds. You tell Progressive how much you want to pay for car insurance, and they'll show you coverage options that fit your budget. Get your quote today at Progressive.com to join the over 28 million drivers who trust Progressive. Progressive Casualty Insurance Company and Affiliates. Price and coverage match limited by state law.
Where'd you get those shoes? Easy. They're from DSW. Because DSW has the exact right shoes for whatever you're into right now. You know, like the sneakers that make office hours feel like happy hour. The boots that turn grocery aisles into runways. And all the styles that show off the many sides of you, from daydreamer to multitasker and everything in between, because you do it all in really great shoes. Find a shoe for every you at your DSW store or DSW.com.
Hey, sports fans, it's Mason Crosby.
And Reese Crosby. If you enjoy football, and brotherly banter, be sure to check out Kicking It with the Crosbys.
Here's some stories from my NFL playing days, goofy conversations about everyday life, giving you entertaining lessons on the pitches across the pond, fun, relatable guests, and what it means to live life on purpose.
New episodes drop every Tuesday and Thursday. Be sure to subscribe to Kicking It with the Crosbys on the free Odyssey app or wherever you get your podcasts.
97.1 FM Talk Podcast.
Glad you're here with us on a Friday morning on the Mark Cox Morning Show. I am Mark, by the way, and that is Kim St. Ange down there. Carl Middleman, Sue Thomas, getting you to work or wherever you're going this morning. If any traffic problems pop up, Sue's going to have it first for you. Happy you're with us. We had a great night last night. I should say my friend Julie Tristan, who works down the hallway here, and I went to the banquet for Guns N' Hoses, and wow. I mean, they just presented a $1 million check earlier this week, and they're already gearing up for next year, and it was great to see Jasmine Huda and all the folks down there. Jasmine's been volunteering for them for like 10 years now, and I worked with her at Channel 4 years ago. It was good to see her. There were lots of Elliot Davis was there last night, ran into him. Attorney General Andrew Bailey showed up for this banquet for Guns N' Hoses, and of course, Colonel Larry O'Toole, who's now the head of Backstoppers, retired colonel from the city, got to talk to him a little bit, and they've got big plans again for this November. They've already started planning for the next one. Steve Hawley apparently was under the weather last night, didn't make it, but congratulations to another great year for them. We're excited to be partnering with them. We'll be their official radio partner, and we will be much more involved, I understand, although I don't know what that means. You know, last year they had a dog rappel from the ceiling down there, and I hope they don't have any plans for me like that. That fear of heights might kick in there at some point.
You'd have a better idea of what was going on than that dog.
I would do that. I've rappelled down a building. I've gone skydiving.
You've gone skydiving?
Yeah.
Really?
Yeah, and I got as part of Special Olympics when I was living in Des Moines, they let me rappel down one of the high rises.
I've rappelled when I was in ROTC years ago, but I've never done the skydiving thing.
Have you, Carl?
Done that.
You have too?
Twice.
Nice.
Wow.
Join the club, Mark.
Yeah, I don't think so.
You're the loser who's never done that, I guess.
As I've gotten older, my concern over heights has heightened.
Here's the thing, Mark. It's the falling, the free fall is great. It's once the chute goes up, it takes a long time for you to reach the bottom.
I'm sure.
But it's beautiful.
It is very pretty. I think the scariest part, but the most thrilling part was when I went tandem because I didn't want to do the 8-hour class or whatever they require. But they open the door, mm-hmm. you know, and the person's behind you and you're basically hanging outside of the plane. And they're like, all right, one, two. And then they just kind of throw you out. But every time they go one, I mean, you're leaning way out over the side of the plane.
You're attached.
But I mean, that's the craziest part. Once you go, I mean, you're flipping and you don't even realize what's happening. You're just enjoying the ride.
Funny feeling in the bottom of my stomach, even as you say that. When I watched those videos on the GoPro mm-hmm. on Facebook that they show all the time, I start getting queasy. I just
I have a video. Do you, Carl?
I have a VHS.
I am not,
a VHS.
It was
there
a
you
few
go.
Years back, huh? Yeah. What you're telling me, Carl?
My cousin wanted to do it on his 21st birthday before we went out to the bars.
Okay.
At least it wasn't after you got back from the bars.
Yeah no kidding. All right, coming up, we got Jim Carafano for you next segment. We'll talk to him about, you know, I don't know if you missed this or not. If you weren't with us last hour, we had a fantastic interview about 6:20 with local attorney Mark Cantor. He is in Israel. He goes over there a couple times a year, but he's been there a lot since the October 7th attacks. He was there yesterday for the funeral procession for the mother and two children who were murdered by Hamas. And there was a rocket attack. Now, I haven't seen it reported in the mainstream media here yet. It was repelled by the Iron Dome. We're supposed to be in the middle of a ceasefire. We're going to talk to our friend Jim Carafano about that. And you can hear our interview with Mark Cantor on the podcast, which is already up and posted. Just go to 971talk.com or your Odyssey app, wherever you download your podcasts, and look for it. We've already got that up there for you. Bottom of the hour. Congressman Eric Burleson. We're doing this every Friday now. We call it the Capitol Beat. We're going to have different representatives who are up in Washington joining us, senators, representatives. We'll get them on here and find out what's going on with the budget and DOGE and cuts and everything else. Also, Kim on a whim here before the end of the hour. But first, I want to get to some of our top stories, please.
The Mark Cox Shortlist.
I do not invoke the specter of Nazis lightly, but I know the history intimately and have spent more time than probably anyone in this room with people who survived the Holocaust.
Well, he's also spent more time than most people in the room at a buffet. That is J.B. Pritzker, the governor of Illinois, obviously running for president already. Every day he's out with something, some new condemnation of Donald Trump. So yesterday he just decided to dredge up the old Nazi comment. How ridiculous.
And I will use the term gaslight, because that's what they were doing. The campaign, former colleagues, the message to everybody was to make sure that you tell people, it's too early, it's too early.
Yeah, that I'll play more of that for you. That's Michael LaRosa, former staffer for Jill Biden, talking about the cover-up of Joe Biden's dementia. Now they're all admitting something we all knew 4 years ago. Isn't it amazing?
President, do you still think that Mr. Zelensky is a dictator?
Did I say that? I can't believe I said that. Next question.
Donald Trump yesterday, like, how are you going to host Vladimir Zelensky after calling him a dictator? Trump looks at him and goes, did I say that? It's a master class for the media every day.
By the way, I don't think anyone knew what Joe Biden was saying in the first place. Yeah. But President Trump is so precise with the way that he hits it. And that's why it's must-see TV. It's ratings gold.
That's Jason Miller. Did you recognize that name? Of course, he worked for President Trump last time around. He was on yesterday talking about the kerfuffle, the dust-up over Donald Trump. And every time the media goes sideways on him, how dare he refer to Vladimir Zelensky as a dictator just because they haven't held elections in 4 or 5 years and he's still the president. Okay, well, it's because Ukraine's constitution says they can hold an election in a time of war. I've heard that excuse. But Donald Trump precisely states what he means. And then he gets results at the end of it, and it drives them crazy. Guess who's in the United States this morning, anxious to sign a deal with the United States for mineral rights? The left, they're losing their collective minds. Guess who else was here yesterday? The British Prime Minister, bringing a letter inviting Trump, the King is inviting Trump back to England again for a second state visit, which is unprecedented, I think is how he put it yesterday. It's winning at every level, and it's driving the left insane. They don't know what to do with it. That's what Jason Miller was talking about when he said this yesterday.
And one of the things I don't think President Trump gets enough credit for is I would say that he's the greatest political speaker that has ever lived. He takes these amazingly complex issues, whether it be about the economy, whether it be about securing the border, bringing about these peace deals, but he distills it down into very easily deliverable, simple ways of communicating. So you can be a regular person. You might not follow politics or read the newspaper every day, but you understand right. Exactly what he's saying because he talks about how it pertains to you and your life and not a bunch of Washington gobbledygook, which is basically what you've seen from Joe Biden. And by the way, I don't think anyone knew what Joe Biden was saying in the first place.
Yeah.
But President Trump is so precise with the way that he hits it. And that's why it's must-see TV. It's ratings gold.
Yeah, I think he's right.
Gobbledygook, what a great word.
Yeah, with Joe Biden and gobbledygook. And I'll get back to that other soundbite for you, I promise, where Biden's former staffer, Jill Biden's former staffer, admits he's in meetings where they're basically being told to gaslight the American public over Joe Biden's clear mental decline over the 4 years. I mean, we were saying it when he got elected. All right, let's get to a break here. J.J. Carafano on the other side of the break from Heritage. We'll be back. The
difference between Israel and the terrorists. There was no one screaming to kill Arabs. There was no one screaming to murder. We were the Druze were there. The Israeli people were there. My friend, who's a lieutenant colonel in the Israeli Defense Forces, is with me. His name's Daniel Jacob.
You know, I was born in the South.
All right, Jim Carafano, welcome in. How are you, my friend?
I am living the dream.
That was an interview I did with my friend, a local attorney here in St. Louis named Mark Cantor, who's in Israel, and he was there for that Bibas family funeral yesterday. And he told me some breaking news that I had not heard reported in the mainstream media yet, that during that parade for their funeral, somebody in Hamas fired a rocket that the Iron Dome intercepted in the middle of a ceasefire.
Wow.
What in the world is going on over there? I mean, it sounds like this thing may be on shaky ground.
Yeah, it might be. And who knows if they'll return to actual fighting or not. But the question, you know, that I get and the huge debates and everything is What's the future of Gaza after this comes to an end? And as obviously as significant that is for all the displaced people and for the future security and Israel and everything else, you know, I keep pointing out that the genius of the Trump plan in the first term was to play the long game. Everybody wanted to wrap their problems in the situation in Gaza and the West Bank because that essentially allows them to avoid doing anything else. And what Trump did, which is so brilliant, was he said, look, we're not going to hold the pace of the region to figuring out what happens to these couple of square miles. And I think the administration's got to get back to that. They've got to focus on the big picture, dealing with Iran. We have to settle situations in Syria. What's the future of Lebanon look like? Getting back to the Abraham Accords. These are things that are going to determine the future of the region, not what happens to this couple of square miles of dirt.
Yeah, it's a good point.
I wanted to ask you about these tariffs that are about to take effect. I think, is it this upcoming Tuesday, sometime next week? I think they're supposed to take effect for Canada and Mexico. Do you think that's going to be as effective? Because a lot of this, I feel like, is Trump just trying to ultimately get what he wants. It's not really about the tariff itself.
So here's all I have to tell you. Zelensky is a dictator. Oh, wait, did I say that? No, he's a great leader. Right. So this is I don't know the future of the tariffs because it's very, very clear they're part of the president's negotiating strategy. And I do on China, I think it's different. The president's trying to wean American strategic dependencies off of China. They're an unstable, dangerous, not good economic partner for the United States. Doing business with China is like, you know, having Hannibal Lecter over to, you know, for a barbecue. It's just not working. So the tariffs, I think, on China are really to – and actually, you know what? This is a weird thing, but if you're not trading with your enemy, it's actually safer for both sides. Everybody's actually better off when you're not – people think that trade makes you friends. It doesn't. If you're friends, it's fine. But if you're enemies, it actually breeds discontent and violence. And so actually not trading with China is safer for us and safer for China.
Yeah, but my order from Temu may not make it, Jim.
All right. I have nothing but no sympathy for you.
You mean the orders that take like 6 months to get there? You pay $2 for a cheapo dress, and then I'm not saying I'm hating on it. I'm just saying
he's gonna get the thing. He's gonna get his Timo thing. Don't worry about that. It's gonna come in the mail. One is all the instructions will be in Chinese.
Yes, I've seen that.
It's going to be made of like things that are so toxic that they're probably going to kill the postman before it gets there. So I'm wishing them all the luck with that.
I can honestly say I've never ordered anything from Temu. I know it's been done in my family. I've not personally done it.
You can always get new family.
With the money you save buying on Temu, you can buy a new family.
Right. Now they've got my credit card information anyway, so it doesn't matter. They know everything. Hey, you know, I wanted to ask you, you brought up the Zelensky thing. Is he a dictator? Is he not? I played that soundbite earlier. Did I say that from Donald Trump? And yet, despite all of that and supposed anger by Zelensky, he's in the United States this morning to meet with President Trump to sign the agreement that everybody claimed he wasn't going to sign.
Yeah, I think it's game over. If the United States is going to invest in Ukraine, obviously, you know, we're not abandoning it to the Russians. People have probably figured that out about Donald Trump right now. You just had the British Prime Minister, who, by the way, has no reason to be nice to Donald Trump. I mean, and he basically said Donald Trump has changed the game. He's the first chance for peace. The Russians have no cards to play. And, you know, I had this argument with Europeans for days because people kept calling me and saying, and there's zero evidence that Trump is going to give anything to the Russians. And this is it. Putin has nothing. He has nothing. He has nothing to offer us. He has nothing to trade. He has nothing to give. And the United States just signaled that, one, we're actually extending sanctions for another year. And two, we're actually investing in Ukraine now, which means we're not letting the Russians take it over. So if you're Vladimir Putin, you're negotiating with somebody who has all the cards, and you don't even have a seat at the table.
Well, I think you're right. I mean, I hope people realize that are so critical of this. What would you rather have? And maybe you could make the argument you'd rather have NATO membership, but maybe you'd rather have the United States of America as a 50-50 business partner in ventures inside of Ukraine so they have a stake in what's going on there.
Yeah, I totally would. You know, the whole NATO thing, I don't really think is relevant. You know me. I'm the biggest fan NATO's ever had. I'm a huge fan of NATO enlargement. I think NATO brings value for money. But the reality is the only thing that Putin respects is force. And you could put 35,000 peacekeepers in Ukraine. You know what that is? That's a week's casualty. So the only thing that's going to defend Ukraine in the future is Ukraine that can defend itself. And if the U.S. is investing and Ukraine is a free and independent country, it is going to be an obstacle to Putin that is insurmountable.
Yeah.
Whether it's in NATO today or next week or next year or 20 years from now, that's irrelevant. And I think people have to wrap their head around that.
Yeah, that's a good point. I wish Ukraine had realized that in about, was it 2010 when the Russians took Crimea?
Well, you know, 2014. But, if Ukrainians had joined NATO 15 years ago, right before any of this started, none of this would have started.
Yep.
But they chose not to. And so, you know, they have to live with the consequences of their decision.
Jim Carafano, you have a great weekend, my friend. Thank you.
Thanks for having me, brother.
You're the best. We appreciate you. All right, we're going to be back in just a minute. We'll talk to Congressman Eric Burleson from D.C.
We are going to balance this budget, and we are going to pay off the debt under President Trump.
Capital Beat.
All right, we've got Congressman Eric Burleson on the phone with us this morning, and great to have him back. That was Howard Lutnick talking, the Commerce Secretary, about trying to pay down debt. To do that, you got to have a budget. And you guys have been working on that, Eric. Thank you.
Oh, yeah. It's not been easy. I can tell you that.
No, I'll bet not. You know, I was watching the mainstream media meltdown over it. The Republicans barely passed a budget. Well, guess what? If it's a party line vote, it's always going to be barely when you can only afford to lose one or two votes, right?
That's right. And so to me, this was, kudos to Mike Johnson and to leadership for being able to wrangle this. They had to deal with fiscal hawks like me who want to balance the budget and cut as much spending as possible because We believe all of the problems that we're facing, whether it's inflation and then not being able to, be able to be strong when it comes to these national security issues,
right,
all stem from our debt and the deficits that we're facing. So we just got to get it under control.
I know you said that you were able to get, what, 6 or 7 times the cuts that they originally were talking about by the time the negotiation was over?
Yeah, that's right. So a lot of the Fiscal Hawks, Freedom Caucus, we joined with members, a lot of them on the budget committee, who are very fiscally conservative. And we started strategizing all the way back in November after the election. We were strategizing what this reconciliation package should look like. We were a little bit more aggressive in our original aspirations. But then when we got to the beginning of the year, when leadership proposed its baseline of how much it's going to cut in spending, it was very anemic. They were going to cut $300 billion over a 10-year period. Now, that is, think about that. That's about $30 billion in cuts out of a $7 trillion spent.
Wow.
Okay? Right. And you can see why I laughed at that proposal. Yeah. And we all laughed at that. So what we got was to bump that up by 7 to at least, at the minimum, the floor has to be a $2 trillion cut over the next 10 years. That's at least $200 billion out of the $7 trillion. Now, that is not enough, as much as I would like, but I feel like that's as far as we could stretch the moderates in our conference to go at this time.
We have to talk about the Epstein files. It was a whole lot of nothing yesterday. Pam Bondi kind of talked it up, saying it was going to reveal all this information, and so we're all kind of waiting with bated breath. Nothing that we didn't already know. Now she's upset, demanding an investigation from Kash Patel into why this information was not given to her. Do you think that's ever actually going to happen? Are we finally going to see all these names of the people who took those flights?
I think I don't know whether they're going to be able to get the information or not. I'm trying to withhold criticism, but let me. I think if she had hindsight into this, she wouldn't have said before she took office that she has the files sitting on her desk. And because she until she found out that, the files on my desk are not really anything.
What we thought, so, yeah.
And so she kind of got everybody's anticipation up. But now she knows she's got more places to look to try to get that information. I hope that she's able to do it. She also kind of fumbled the release of this. I'm on the disclosure task force. We are working with the White House to try to coordinate. We're a team that's supposed to be part of this. We're supposed to be read in. We have security clearances to read these documents. And so that did not happen. So there's been a lot of communication back and forth how that failed. And so I think that going forward, we're going to be more aggressive in trying to be helpful in getting the right documents and getting them released.
Yeah. Well, I mean, you want to believe that they're going to do that. You guys have got a lot on your hands, a lot that's going on all over the place. You know, one thing I wanted to mention was this bill ending the Cycle of Dependency Act. You know, people have tried this before to get welfare to work and all this stuff going on. What's different about this effort?
Yeah, so this is a bill that I'm sponsoring, and I wanted your listeners to understand so they can refute what the left is going to say about this topic. You remember in the 90s when Bill Clinton and Al Gore, they famously were cutting, government spending, and they reached across the aisle with Republicans, and they worked out a deal where they instituted work requirements into the TANF program, food stamp program, Medicaid, all of them,
yes,
into all of the welfare programs. They said, we're going to take care of the people who really need it. We're going to take care of people if they're disabled, if they're blind, if you're a senior citizen, you can't afford your nursing home care. We're going to take care of you. We're going to take care of children who are in poverty and their mothers. Right. But then what they said is, but you know, who really should be actually, instead of collecting a check from the government, should be out there producing are the people who are able-bodied, working-aged adults. And so they said, so they instituted work requirements saying, if you're going to get money from the federal government, if you're going to get aid, you need to at least be working a job, or you need to be trying to find a job, or you need to be going to school to get a job. Just check any of those boxes, and we'll continue to support your welfare. And if you're not, then we're not going to continue to enable you to be unproductive. I think that that's common sense.
I agree. That makes complete sense to me. And I think what was so frustrating, especially during the COVID era, was people were receiving a lot of benefits. And I don't know if that would have, I guess, been unemployment, but it was almost as if they needed to show that they were trying to find a job. So I would hear from people who own businesses who would say, we'd have so many people applying for these jobs. We'd want them to come in for an interview. They would just no-show us, or maybe they would get the job and then they would show up for a day and not ever come back. And so that's what I also want reined in is actually, you know, having a job and holding it versus being like, oh, I'm looking. See, I went on 15 interviews in the last month.
Yeah, Kim, I love that. I really appreciate that input. That's something that I've heard myself, and I need to add that to this bill to make it better. So I appreciate that. And yeah, you're right. Like this bill does is it reinstitutes the Clinton era work requirements. And the reason why they have to be reinstituted is because Obama waived many of these work requirement rules and then expanded the program, expanded Medicaid. And then Joe Biden did the same thing. Joe Biden put in 13 executive orders to basically eliminate work requirement rules and then also expanded the population to the point where today it is the biggest population. They are eclipsing all of the people who are disabled, all of the children, all the pregnant mothers, all the people in nursing homes. There's more people who are young and working age who are on these programs than the people who actually need it. And they are bankrupting the United States government. We're spending $618 billion a year on this program. It's growing. It's estimated to reach $1 trillion. And so enough is enough. We need to return to fiscal sanity, pre-COVID era spending.
Amen. Congressman Eric Burleson with us. You know, I'd point out that it was Obamacare that expanded Medicaid, and it's just exploded, and it's unsustainable. I don't know who could look at that program and think that it could keep growing at that rate with the kind of debt this country carries.
That's right. That's why one of the solutions I am on board with that I would absolutely support is that we block grant the money to the states. I think we should do that with Medicaid. I think we should do it with Medicare, but we should do that with education. We need to block grant this money, write one check to the state and say, you are smart enough to do a better job than we are. You can take this money and probably build a better healthcare system for your participants than the federal government can. And I think that the states will do that, but it will also stop the growth in this program, because right now the states are incentivized to get more people on the program, because the more people, the bigger the check the federal government has to write.
Amen.
And so that will stop that.
Well, thanks for doing all the hard work up there, Congressman. We appreciate the update on it, and keep us informed.
Absolutely. Have a great weekend.
Yeah, you too. We'll talk to you soon. Congressman Eric Burleson there from the 7th Congressional District here in Missouri. Trying to get somebody on every Friday for this segment, the Capitol Beat, and keep you updated on efforts up there to kind of change government. That's the only way you can look at it. They're trying to reform something that's never really been reformed. The Clinton era paid lip service to it, but everything got reversed just a few short years later.
Mm-hmm.
And it might again, but you need to put some permanent change. Not just empty out some of those federal buildings that aren't being used, sell them so they can't fill them back up.
Mm-hmm.
You know? I don't know. It's a good idea. What are we talking about on Kim and a Whim?
Well, it's Friday. It's the last day of February. The sun is up. Let's talk about something really uplifting. The death penalty.
Oh, perfect.
Guy in South Carolina wants to die by firing squad. Should he be allowed to?
Sign me up. We'll be back.
Kim on a Whim.
For the first time in 15 years here in the United States, an inmate will be put to death by a firing squad.
Wow.
There was a request by an inmate in Missouri back in 2021 to have that done, and the person was not wanting the lethal injection, and that request was denied. So this actually is a big deal. Brad Sigmund is set to be put to death on March 7th. People, the police say that he, well, he was convicted, I should say, of killing his ex-girlfriend's parents, that he beat them to death with a baseball bat back in 2001. Listen to part of this report about concerns that his attorney had when it comes to the lethal injection and why he wanted the firing squad instead.
His attorneys argue the state's execution methods are inhumane. They say lethal injection has led to prolonged deaths and the electric chair would, quote, burn and cook him alive. His legal team, though, has one final appeal. They're hoping to stop the execution and push for a sentence of life without parole.
Yeah, yeah, I've heard that. People who have opted for the electric chair, I covered a case like that when I was reporting in Nashville, Tennessee. Someone said that lethal injection, the three cocktail mix that they give you to do the job, basically, they say it can be similar to burning alive. And that's why they think it's inhumane. And then you heard him just talking about the electric chair.
Sure.
So it's kind of interesting. Is this something that we're going to see happening in more and more states? Maybe with Trump in office? Because there is so much talk about, is this humane? To be honest with you, when you've beaten to death people with a baseball bat, something so gruesome, which is what you find on death row, I don't have that much sympathy. Like, the victims didn't get to choose how they were put to death. They didn't say, you know what, that would be too painful to be killed that way. Could you do something different? They didn't get a choice in that.
Well, they didn't. My problem with the death penalty, and I don't have a problem with people being put to death who committed murders, is that it doesn't happen fast enough. So back in about 1990, there was a guy in South Carolina named Larry Eugene Hall who walked into the parking lot of like a Walmart, some big store, and he assassinated twin sisters. One was old enough to drive, the other one wasn't, so she drove her sister up there to shop. He caught him in the parking lot and he killed them. And they sentenced him to death. I covered his entire trial when I was a reporter down there. And 10 years later, I'm working in St. Louis, and I get a phone call down at Channel 4 at my desk, and they're like, is this the Mark Cox that used to work at WYFF in Greenville? I'm like, yes. They're like, we're part of this, justice organization that doesn't believe in the death penalty, and we're trying to save Larry Eugene Hall from the electric chair in South Carolina. And I'm like, you don't seem to understand. You've called the wrong guy. Well, didn't you cover that trial? Couldn't you describe his condition for us? I'm like, I won't. Because whatever you're trying to do, I would pull the switch. I'm fully in favor of that. There was no doubt about this guy's guilt. My question to you is this. How many people do you know who are convicted felons?
I don't personally know if I personally...
Carl?
Well, I don't think any... Maybe like one.
Like, I know a couple.
Guilty of a murder?
No, none.
No.
So to be...
Maybe.
To be tried...
What? I'm sorry. Wait. You might know somebody who's been convicted of murder. We can't just skate past that.
Vehicular homicide.
Okay.
To be tried and convicted of murder on a death penalty case, they don't just lightly charge you with that to begin with. The odds of these people being innocent are far flung. These are just people that don't like the death penalty in general. I'd say if you do something that heinous, you deserve to be removed from the population permanently, and I'm all in favor of it. So I don't care if it's a firing squad or hanging or lethal injection or Old Sparky down in Florida. I'm 100% in favor of it.
Well, public hanging is what they used to do.
Right.
I mean, and it wasn't like this. Now, I do understand why there are appeals, and that's what makes someone on death row. It is incredibly expensive because there's so many appeals, and even up until the last second before they're actually put to death, they have a phone right there in the room waiting to see if they'll get a stay on it, and there's one
that
last appeal that's granted.
Only in movies.
Yeah. I've seen them kind of waiting for it, or I've heard about them when I've covered these outside of a jail.
I would draw the line at like the ending of the movie Braveheart. Like, I wouldn't support that kind of torture being stretched and gutted on the public hangings. The reason they were effective is that nobody ever wanted to find themselves in that situation. Mm-hmm. And you knew what course of action you needed to take to avoid ending up at a hangman's noose.
Uh-huh.
And We've eliminated that. So it's really no longer the kind of thing that people would look at and say, well, I shouldn't commit that crime because I might die, because they know odds are they won't.
Uh-huh. Like, I'm not saying I'm in favor of or against this per se. Let me just throw this out there as a scenario. Let's say that the punishment for someone convicted of drunk driving was that your hand was chopped off. Automatic hand chopped off. How many people, like something like that, how many, would that deter more people?
They don't have many theft problems in countries where they do that.
Like, that's what I mean. Like, not even just, oh, but you're going to be killed, but something that's very public where you are going to lose a leg. Would that be enough of a deterrent? Maybe.
Was that,
I don't know.
Where was that caning incident that time?
Singapore.
It was in Singapore.
What was that?
They caught an American student stealing something and they sentenced him to, the punishment was caning, where they publicly take a cane and beat your backside with it until you're bloody. That's the punishment for it.
That's like biblical times with being stoned to death.
There was a they don't kill you.
Right, but they're
but
publicly
you never
beating
forget
you.
It. Well, the problem is, the thing is, they don't have much trouble with theft in Singapore. I'm not pushing for that, but I'm saying where there is an immediate and quick punishment, you have less repeat offenders and you deter other people from doing the same thing.
Yeah. I don't know what I would even advocate for.
Here,
I have to put more thought into all of where I would draw the line.
Michael Fay.
Yeah, I remember I couldn't remember the name, but I remember the case.
Our justice system is broken. He did graffiti and was caned, publicly caned?
Vandalism, yeah.
I think they got him out before it happened, didn't they? I don't know. There was a big outcry in the U.S. They wanted him home. It was a long time ago, that dude. I wonder whatever happened to him. I bet he's walked a straight and narrow since then, hasn't he? Hey, coming up, we're going to talk to Ellisville Police Chief Steve Lewis about the new SAPA bill working its way through Jeff City.
Get more at 971talk.com.